May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable to you, O God, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Well, one might suppose that individuals immortalized with entire books of the Bible dedicated to them were people of great privilege and great power. But history suggests that the prophet Jeremiah began his life with few advantages. He made a career out of antagonizing people in high places. He came from a small tribe in northern Judah and a family associated with a school of has-been priests known as Levites. The Levites had flourished in the early years of Israel's history when territorial judges held the power. But their influence had waned when the tribes were united in one monarchy. Jeremiah's ancestor, Abiathar, was an ally of Adonijah, the loser in the race to succeed King David. So when Solomon took the throne of David, he purged the royal court of everyone associated with his rival, including the entire school of the Levites. So Jeremiah, these many years later, was an insurgent prophet, an outsider with a sharp tongue and a pamphlet of complaints against the ruling government. And what's more, he lived in a time of tremendous geopolitical uncertainty. Ruling Judah at the time was the ambitious and some would say imperious Josiah, whose public rhetoric dramatized a nation that lay in ruin. Josiah promised a return to the prosperity of Judah under the reign of David and Solomon. But Jeremiah said, by contrast, that Judah was losing its way, and he urged the throne to adopt habits of modesty, and he urged the king to put his trust in the providence of God. The people, Jeremiah said, should reject the false promises of the king and put their hope not in the law of government, but in God's faithfulness to a renewed covenant. He testified that God's covenant constituted a higher law than any law that would be passed by King Josiah. "I will put my law within them, and I will write it on my hearts, on their hearts," God had said, "and I will be their God, and they will be my people." Well, you can imagine how the public, or how Jeremiah was treated for his testimonies. His prophecies were met with threats against his life. He says, "I was led like a lamb to the slaughter," about the most dramatic of those threats. Well, I thought of Jeremiah last week when thousands of children walked out of their classrooms to protest the inaction of political leadership to prevent continued gun violence. That evening, the young people of our church assembled here to share their thoughts and feelings about the walkout that they had undertaken during the day. We called it a speak out. And a crowd of 70 or 80 church members had come here to listen to them. These young people spoke with such clarity about how they live with an ongoing and unacceptable threat of gun violence. One student explained, "Guns are defining our lives and threatening our safety." They related to us how they fear that a shooter might enter their school. "My brain just keeps bringing me back," one student said, "because a friend of mine could have died, or I could have died." They said that they often imagined a tragedy like the massacre in Parkland, Florida, happening here in Chapel Hill. But their testimonies included the full range of feelings that all of us know pretty well. Like the feeling of being desensitized to the deaths because school shootings have become such a matter of course in our country. Some students were joking and playing during the walkout because they couldn't imagine it happening here, another student explained. They spoke from the heart, and their honesty connected in a very powerful way with the adults in the room. Well, many of these young people will go next weekend to Washington, D.C. to participate in the nationwide March for Our Lives to urge meaningful gun reform on our policymakers. These students, let me tell you, are frightfully articulate. Someone should call our senators just to warn them, as they seem to have no idea what is coming their way. I suspect, nevertheless, that when they knock on the doors of power, they will be met with something less than hospitality. Maybe they will even find some dismissiveness there. The commentators may say that they are just young people, and they do not belong here where the adults pass the laws. But our church gathered them together this week because we believe that they belong exactly there. They don't need anyone's permission to be good citizens. And I hope that they will remember when they go that they haven't been the first prophets harassed for speaking the truth. For was it not also said about the prophet Jeremiah that he didn't belong, and that he should go back to his little hamlet in the hills, since his ancestors had been banished from the capital of Jerusalem? But I believe that if they speak in Washington with the authenticity with which they have spoken to our church, God will use their voices to soften even the hard and cynical heart of a polarized capital. And that, by the way, I believe is our only hope. For when the arguments have crystallized into unmovable ideologies, our hope for change is in making a more humane connection with one another. One adult left the speak out on Wednesday and said to me that she hadn't before realized the fear, the very deep and genuine sense of fear that young people carry into their classrooms. And she had learned something new that night, not from argumentation, but from the hearing of a genuinely told story. She predicted there would be no change in Washington until lawmakers could also feel the fear. The prophet Jeremiah says today that God's law is not written on stone tablets. It's not written on stone tablets because if it were written on stone tablets, then it might not ever be changed. Jeremiah says that there is a higher law, the law of grace, that is written deep within the human heart. And that makes me think that when we speak from the heart, we have the power to change what is written in stone. Well, Jesus was himself Jewish, so he spends most of his time interpreting Jewish law. And that raises an understandable question. Has Jesus come only for intercourse with Jewish people? If you're not Jewish, how are you supposed to relate to the life of Jesus? So in today's gospel reading, we have an episode about how a small group of non-Jewish Greeks seek to engage with the Jewish Messiah. Several disciples are present, and they seem to be cast in the role of bouncers. Maybe they think that their job is to control access to their leader. So one of the Greeks approaches the group and meets the gatekeeper, Philip, and says very plainly, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." And Philip confers with Andrew, and Andrew disappears into some back room somewhere and confers with Jesus, and finally Jesus emerges. And without so much as waiting for an introduction from his visitors, or waiting for them to ask a question, he unleashes a very dramatic monologue. And this is a speech about how the time has come for him to take up the cross. And when I am lifted from the earth, he concludes, I will draw all people to myself. Well, some commentators have protested that Jesus speaks in this passage without even being asked a question. You know, a few curiously out of place Greeks arrive, and Jesus opens up a big can of mansplaining. Was Jesus really listening to them? Well, fair point, maybe. But what if the author John is trying to do something a little different here? Maybe the Greek visitors don't ask a question because any Greek visitor is the question. Jesus doesn't wait for a question because their presence poses an implicit question. What is that question? Do we belong here? The Greeks have never been included before. Heretofore, Jewish law and Gentile traditions have been pretty strictly separate. So Jesus answers the implicit question by saying, I will draw all people to myself. All people. When I am lifted up, all people will see me, and I will draw all people to myself, which is another way of saying, yes, 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 you belong here. I mean, maybe you can relate. Maybe you've never asked this question because you were the question. Maybe you know what it means to be the problem in the room. Or maybe you can't relate to these Greek visitors. What if you've never had to wonder whether you belong? What if you've never been the problem because you've always had the privilege? Because, you know, some people can just go anywhere. And they don't have to wonder if they belong because they can occupy whatever space they please. The Greek visitors, by contrast, represent so many people who have wondered, who have genuinely wondered, even if they've never asked, whether they belong. Their bodies pose the question. This is the woman in the conference room that is filled with men, wearing a confident and serious face because she knows she has to meet a double standard. She never asked because she can't appear weak, but she wonders, do I belong here? This is any person of color in a room of blinding whiteness. Their bodies pose the question that goes unspoken. Do I belong here? This is the transgender man or woman in the bathroom moving quickly and efficiently to do their business and wash up, because who wants to be asked in a bathroom of all places if you're out of place? So Jesus, who represents the God who created us and knows us most intimately, doesn't even wait for the question. He answers the question that he knows is on our hearts before we can even express our insecurity. Jesus meets it with grace. Yes, yes, you belong here, he says, because I have been lifted up for all people. So John is saying that Jesus comes not just for the Jew, but also for the Greek. Not just for the righteous, also for the guilty. Not just for the believers, also for the doubters. Not just for the privileged, also for the oppressed. And the Apostle Paul will later wrestle with this passage in his letter to the Romans. He concludes without equivocation, God's grace shows no partiality. Don't let anyone tell you where you belong. You belong because you are. Did the door not open for the Greeks who asked, Sir, we wish to see Jesus? Ask and you shall receive. Knock and the door will be opened to you. Seek and you will find. So to the youth, we can say with confidence this morning, go and knock on the doors of power with the audacity of Jeremiah. Claim your place at the table because Jesus has already made a place for you there. Tell the story that God has written on your heart. because the God who gave you a heart also gave you a voice. For the grace of God shall one day be the law of the land, and it is a much higher law than any law that is written in books or written in stone. God has written this law, a law of everlasting grace, a law of unconditional love, the law of your sanctification and your worthiness. God has written this law in you. Amen.